From Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department now offers boxed lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655. WILO programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, offering over 30 varieties and blends of whole bean or ground coffee at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Coffee, tea, and chai are available from their retail store, in local restaurants, and through Columbia Street Roastery's coffee service. More information is available at 352-9713.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. On the program this afternoon, we'll get a glimpse of the wonder of a child's imagination and consider the importance of imagination throughout life. Our guest is writer and artist Ellen Handler Spitz. She says young children slip back and forth between the imaginary and the wider world, what she calls the domain of shared cultural experience. Would you like an example? Well, Spitz says think of Calvin, of Bill Watterson's comic strip Calvin and Hobbes. Think about the strips where Calvin becomes Spaceman Spiff. Wonderful flights of fantasy. Then there's Hobbes, the energetic, sometimes ferocious, sardonic, stuffed tiger. Ellen Handler Spitz writes about the imagination of children and their aesthetic development in the new book, The Brightening Glance, Imagination and Childhood. We'll talk with her this afternoon about imagination and the minds of young children, how to foster aesthetic development, and what we as adults can learn from the wonder of children. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Ellen Handler Spitz is a professor in the Honors College and Department of Visual Arts at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. In addition to The Brightening Glance, she is the author of Inside Picture Books. Again, the phone numbers, if you'd like to join the conversation this afternoon, 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. And let me mention that our guest, Professor Spitz, will be visiting the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign next week. She will be speaking at the Krannert Art Museum next Wednesday, the 19th at 5:30 p.m. That's April 19th. 2006. Professor Spitz, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, I'm delighted to be with you.
What led you to your interest in the aesthetic development of children?
Oh, my word. Oh, it's just been a lifelong project. I think it's a book that's been always sort of in the writing ever since I was a very little girl. So it's something that really has taken me a lifetime to write, and actually, if you've had a chance to look at it, you'll see that there is a little girl in this book who kind of, you know, runs away from school and hides and does all sorts of things. So it's been something that's been very important to me, really, forever.
Yeah. Why is it, do you think, some people are more connected to that time of their life than others? I mean, for me, in the chapter that you talk about children's spaces, I was right there immediately. But there are other things that I have to stop and think about a little bit, you know, like in terms of what was my favorite toy, you know, that kind of thing, and what was my favorite game, because there's so much there, and it takes some time to pull up those memories. But why is it, do you think, someone like yourself? Obviously, you have a real strong pull to that time in your life.
You know, I think we're all so different, and I think some of us remember different sorts of things. And for some of us, it is the spaces, and for some of us, it may be sounds. It may be certain music or sounds or smells. I mean, I think we have pulls back people. You know, sometimes it's people. It's, you know, a beloved grandparent, or it's stories. When I wrote my last book, Inside Picture Books, I had, when I was on the radio talking to people, oh my goodness, people had so many stories that they remembered from their childhood, so many books, so many picture books and fairy tales and stories. So I think that we do remember different sorts of things. And children, you know, children have different kinds of sensibilities. You know, some children are just more visual, some are more physical, you know, more sort of, you know, kinesthetic. And some children are more verbal, and they respond to verbal stimuli. And some are like little scientists, and they're always trying to figure out, you know, how things are put together and how things work and taking things apart. There's a wonderful book which I would recommend to everyone. And it's actually an old book, but a wonderful book called The Magic Years by Selma Freiberg. And she talks about those differences in children. And I think that and because of those differences, I think we remember different sorts of things. But what I do think very strongly is that when you, as an adult, want to get in touch with the imaginative lives of the children that you know today, one technique, if I can use that word, that really is helpful is to try to remember what it felt like when you were little. If you can even remember anything, if you can even just get in touch with it, it's so wonderful. It's so helpful to be able to do that.
Hmm. Books and stories, they were very important to you as a child. Was it something you did by yourself, or did you seek out adults to tell you a story?
Well, I was very fortunate. My mother read to us. I have a sister, and my mother read to the two of us. It must have been every night before we went to bed. I know I so encourage parents to do this with children. And my mother didn't just read stories. She often read poetry. And poetry is wonderful because poetry is read in a very different way from stories. With poetry, you have to slow down and you have to focus on the rhythms and the sounds of the words, and it's a little bit like music. And it sensitized me so much to language, and I so loved it. I also think that when you're an adult, whether you're a parent or a teacher or an aunt or an uncle or just a very good friend of a child, and you sit down with that child and open a book and read, it's a magical moment because you know, it's not that hurry up voice. You use a different voice, and you go to a different place with that child. I was reading actually last night to a little boy, and I was reading the story, this wonderful Hans Christian Andersen story of Hialmar and how he goes into this picture in his bedroom, and he actually gets transported into the picture, and he has this wonderful adventure inside of the picture in his bedroom. And you know, we were there. We were in that picture together, and it was wonderful. And then, you know, when the little boy comes out and he stands and he sits at the edge of the frame of the picture and his legs dangle out and he has to go back to his bedroom, well, there we were, our legs dangling out, and this little boy had to go to sleep. And so I think you enter into something wonderful. And I think that's so important today. We all spend so much time in the real world in a way, and it's important to be able to get out of it.
Yeah, you mentioned Donald Winnicott in the book.
Yes,
meeting and matching the moment. What is that?
Well, I think Donald Winnicott was a very interesting person. He was actually a pediatrician in England. Eventually, he became a psychoanalyst and worked with adults. But he spent most of his life working with children in Paddington Green Hospital in London. And when he saw a child in his office, no matter what the reason, he always felt that a child should go away with something. And sometimes he would take a little piece of paper and he would fold it up and make a little folded paper object for the child so that the child would always go away from the doctor's office with something in his hand. And he had this idea of meeting and matching the moment of hope, as he put it. And what he meant by that is that when a child comes to you all excited with something, even the simplest thing, and the adult, mother, father, any of the adult to whom the child approaches responds in that moment and says, oh, wow, oh, yes, it's wonderful. This is a special kind of recognition and for the child. And it's the child then feels that someone in the outside world understands, and that those moments just build inside a child. But when a child, when the mother is, or I say mother, but I don't really mean to only mother, I'm just using as a metaphor, it could be any adult, always pushes the child away and says, well, not now, later. I'm busy. I'm on the phone. I'm talking to someone. I can't do it now. The child gets that sort of deflated feeling, almost like, you know, a balloon that the air is sort of going out slowly from the balloon. And when that happens a lot, then the child sort of, it becomes sad, and the child doesn't go anymore and say, look at this. Mm. It's so important for us to be able to respond. And I don't mean all the time. I mean, who could do that? And you wouldn't, that's unrealistic. But just to be able to match that moment of a child's excitement is so nourishing for the inner life of a child. We think a lot about nourishing children nutritionally. We think of the importance of the food that they eat. We know how important it is for them to be safe and warm and comfortable and hold their hand when they cross the busy street. But we also want to nourish their inner lives. And that's what I think Winnicott meant by this beautiful phrase, meeting and matching the moment of hope.
Hmm. There's one of the vignettes, one of the anecdotes in the book is about a little girl who is visiting a relative, I believe, with her mother, and they are in a high-rise building in the city of New York, I believe. And she says to her mother, she remarks about what she sees out the window. And her mother was there for her at that moment. The little girl said, it is royal blue.
Yes. And the mother hadn't noticed it before. She'd been so busy talking to all the other relatives at this family gathering that she hadn't noticed how beautiful that landscape was. And that's another thing that's very important, is that small children, or even elementary age children, rarely use the words like beautiful or lovely, or but they pull you over, or they push you, or they say, look, and they do notice things, and when they do, it makes it so wonderful. We as adults, I think, and my mother was certainly guilty of this, or maybe I shouldn't use the word guilty, but we are always pointing things out to children. Look at this, look at that. In fact, one of my very funny memories from childhood is of the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus, which is a three-ring circus. And I remember sitting with my mother, and we went every year, and my mother was incorrigible. She would say, look, 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 look. And I remember my head just going back and forth trying to see everything. But we need, I think, to also let the children point things out to us. And if we just cede the control a little bit and just relax and step back and let them notice what they're looking at, notice what matters to them. Let me just give you one little anecdote that I totally love, which is this vision of a little one going for the first time to preschool. And the mother is late, and she is very worried, or she thinks she's late. She's worried about being late. And they're walking down a corridor together. And the little one is being held with his left hand by the mother, but his right hand, with his right hand, he's touching the wall of the corridor, and he's just feeling that wall with his fingers as they walk down the corridor together. And the mother is yanking him along with her right hand, his left hand. And what I saw when I saw this, what I said to myself was, this little boy just wants to feel his way into this new experience. Mm. He's touching that wall. He needs to just feel his way in. This is a momentous moment for him. And the mother is so concerned about the social propriety of being on time and being there on time that she's pulling him. And this is such a metaphor, I think, for our relationship to children. We want them to succeed. We want them to know the right way to do things. We want them to be polite. We want all these things for them. And all of those things are good. But because of this, we don't really sometimes listen and watch and let things come from them.
Mm. I need to peel away what's not important. But there's so much on one's plate sometimes.
Yes.
I wonder, though, if this explains in part the powerful bonds children can make with older adults, grandparents, for instance. Because it seems grandparents maybe have had some time to peel away what's not important.
Oh, that's a very... I think that's beautiful. It's so very, very often very, very true because, in my book, I mentioned a couple of anecdotes that do involve grandparents, and it's very amusing. They were very amusing to me because the grandparents would always say things like, "Well, but my child never noticed, you know, the leaves fluttering to the ground in fall, or the sounds of birds. Oh, my child never noticed that." But of course, that's not true. All children notice these things. It's just that when you're busy and you're rushing and you're hectic and you've got, you know, one or two or three small children to take care of and you're trying to pick your husband up, you know, mm-hmm. and you're trying to get from here to there and buy the food and cook the food, you can't stop and listen. And the grandparents definitely do have that leisure. They've developed the ability to stop and listen, and they're not on the line in the same way that a young parent is on the line. So it is a very different relationship, and they're not as worried. I think they've brought up their children, and they can be a little more often a little more relaxed. And there are some wonderful, wonderful books. Picture books and children's books about the relationship between grandparents and children. In Inside Picture Books, I wrote about one beautiful, beautiful book, which is called Always Grandma, and in which the little girl in the story decides she wants to fly, and she builds little sort of make-believe wings, and she actually tries to fly, and her mother gets very angry because the mother's afraid that she's going to hurt herself, as a mother would. But the grandmother says to her something like, "Well, someday you're going to do great things," because the grandmother has that sort of that perspective. I do agree with you, and it's very difficult, but I think it's so worthwhile when parents can just... And it involves time. I mean, it's a question of making the time for this.
Hmm. I remember being a child, and I'm recalling this just this very moment, when a great aunt came to visit, and I really didn't know her. And I loved having my shoes and socks off. And my mother was always encouraging me to put the shoes and socks on. And the great aunt said, "Oh, let her run." Let her run with her shoes and socks off. It feels so good. And right then and there, my aunt and I had a connection that you couldn't, you know, we were tight just from that moment on. And I'm also thinking of the great aunt now, because there's a wonderful story you tell about a great aunt in the beginning of the book, where she drops off her great nephew at his Hebrew class. And the great aunt stood at the door and observed the class for a while, and she saw a very talented teacher at work. Do you recall the story?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Would you tell it?
Yes, I'll tell that story. It was, yes, the children were learning colors. They were learning how to tell the colors in Hebrew. And what the teacher had done was she had areas of each color on the floor. And so the child would stand, for example, on red and then say the word red in that language and then stand on yellow and say the word yellow, and so on. So the child, it was a wonderful exercise because each child then had the experience of saying the word, seeing the color, and kinesthetically, actually physically standing right on the color, so that it was a wonderful way for the child to really internalize this word that meant this particular color, whatever the color was. And each child had to go up. And she had all the little ones go up and say the color and say the word red, blue, yellow, and so on. But then there were two little ones who were very, very shy, and they were terrified to do this. And what the teacher did, which was so wonderful, was she noticed it right away, and she instantly, you know, must have made a decision, and she swooped, and the two little ones that couldn't do it weren't sitting anywhere near each other. And what she did was she just sort of went over without a minute's hesitation and swooped both of them up together in her arms. She swooped them up and plunked them down on a collar and said to them in a very soft voice, "Sometimes it's easier to do something when you have someone else doing it with you." And the two of them then collaborated, and they were able, with each one helping the other, they were able to get it and to say the colors together. And immediately, when all the children then had done it, she then led into song, and the children began to sing. And this was such an amazing exercise because what I wrote about in the book was that the teacher was teaching language, and she was a language teacher. But she saw that psychologically, she saw the need of the children, the shyness of the children, the wish of the children to do it and to get it right, but their fear. And she found a way of bringing them in, making it possible for them to do it, and letting the lesson go on, and everybody then was successful. And what I said in the book was that not every teacher would have done that. Some teachers would have done other things, and they would have been just as successful as what this teacher did. But what mattered was that teacher, what this great aunt saw. What she said to me was that the teacher was able to kind of get inside the child's world and see what was wrong, that the children were shy and afraid. May I tell you one other anecdote? I was in the Virginia Festival of the Book, and I was reading from this brightening glance from my book, and I heard an amazing story, which I would love to tell. A grandmother told me that she had her little grandson for the night. He was sleeping over at her home. And the child had just seen the movie of The Wizard of Oz, and he was much too young, really, or maybe for him it was very, very frightening. He was terrified of the witch in The Wizard of Oz. And when it was time to go to bed, the little boy couldn't go to sleep. And he kept saying to his grandma, "I'm afraid of the witch. The witch is coming. The witch is going to get me." And she and her husband tried everything they could think of. They opened the closet doors, and they said, "Look, the witch is not here." They opened all the chest of drawers. They looked under the bed. They looked behind the curtains. They showed the child, "There is no witch anywhere here. You don't have to worry about the witch." Still, whatever they did, the child was afraid. They used all the logical, adult, rational reasons. And the little boy was still terrified. He couldn't go to bed, couldn't go to sleep, couldn't fall asleep. And finally, this lady did something totally, which is just what I'm advocating in my book, and it was amazing. She went into the bathroom, Celeste, and she took a glass, and she filled the glass with water. And she brought the glass, and she put the glass down next to the, the little boy's bed, and she looked at the little boy and she said, "When the witch comes, here's the water. You can throw the water at the witch." And the little boy relaxed and he smiled and he was able to go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so amazing because she had entered into the child's imaginary world, and she addressed him on the level that he was at. He was afraid of a witch, and the witch for him was as real as all the other elements of reality. And when she was able to see how real that witch was for him and give him the water, give him the weapon that he needed, you know, he could relax. And I thought that story was just fantastic.
Now, that grandmother, the Hebrew teacher, and the great aunt are good listeners, good observers. Thoughts you can share with us here this afternoon about becoming a more astute observer, a better listener?
Yes, well, I think it's very hard to do it. It's not easy for some people. Some people have a gift of that, to do that. And for some people, it's hard. And I would say, if you were to ask me what makes it hard, in addition to all the practical considerations of our lives that make it very hard, we're always hurrying and rushing and paying attention to artificial clock time. But I think on a deeper level, there's another reason why it's so difficult to listen. And that's because when you listen, you don't know what you're going to hear. And you lose control when you're listening to somebody else. A child, if you really listen, a child may say something. You don't know what the child will say. Have you ever heard parents who finish children's sentences for them? Or when the child is introduced to a stranger and the stranger asks the child something, the mother will finish the sentence of her child. It's a wish to control. It's a need to control. And I think, Celeste, that in order to really listen, you have to have the strength to, your own inner strength, to give up that control, at least for a moment or two, to really hear what the other person is saying, and especially if it's a child. And children will come out with all sorts of things, and they will sometimes surprise you if you really listen to them. Does that make sense to you?
Yes. Also, there's sometimes, though, you have to, I don't know, sometimes it's not clear. You're listening, and you're listening hard, but it's not clear quite what the child means.
Well, that's true, too. But with your great aunt, when your great aunt asked your mother to let you go with your wiggle your toes and go barefoot, the reason she did that, I surmise that the reason she did that was because she was remembering how good it felt to her when she was a little girl and she could wiggle her toes and go barefoot and walk barefoot. And that's very, very much why in The Brightening Glance, I couldn't write the book just about contemporary children. I had to write about what things felt like to me when I was little, because that's part of how you kind of get into it. Sometimes you don't understand, but the child will sometimes help you to understand. And there's a back and forth, I think, that goes on. And there are some things we don't understand. We never understand everything, but that's all right, too. I think that what happens, actually, is that children know that you're trying to understand. When you are trying to understand, children know that, you know, and they and they give you a lot of leeway, I think. Just this morning, I was taking my vitamin pills, and I was eating something like a granola, and this little girl was 3 years old, was sitting there, and she asked me whether this little piece of the granola was another vitamin pill. And I said, no, it's not. It's actually a seed. And she said, oh, like a seed that will grow into a flower. And then she took it, and she started to put it into her mouth. And I said, oh, my, what do you think will happen if you put it into your mouth? And we began to laugh that maybe a flower would grow inside of her. And the next time I saw her, perhaps there'd be a flower coming out of her head if she ate this seed. And, you know, it's this kind of thing. Part of it is play, and part of it is humor. Children have a wonderful sense of humor. And that's very, very much in the imaginary world. There's often a lot of sense of fun and play.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, this afternoon our topic is imagination and childhood. Our guest is Ellen Handler Spitz. She is a professor in the Honors College and Department of Visual Arts at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. She is the author of The Brightening Glance, Imagination and Childhood. She's also the author of Inside Picture Books. Next Wednesday, April 19th, 2006, she will be visiting here at the University of Illinois. She will be speaking on the 19th at the Krannert Art Museum at 5:30 p.m. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. What are your thoughts about imagination and childhood? 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You mentioned a moment ago how adults can finish the sentences of children. With that in mind, I ask this question. How can we as adults participate in the play of children without, in a sense, finishing sentences, without being overbearing?
Yes. Yes, I think that's a wonderful question. And it's a kind of a delicate question. In the book, I don't know if you saw it, but I have an anecdote about a little girl whose mommy is making a sandwich for her lunch, was using mayonnaise, and the mayonnaise jar is sitting on the table. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, this little girl starts to talk, to address the mayonnaise jar, and she says, hello, mayonnaise jar. And she starts to have a conversation with the mayonnaise jar. And the mother could have done one of two things. The mother could have just waited and listened to see what would happen. But this mother didn't. This mother jumped right in and took the part of the mayonnaise jar, and she took that role. And she played, and they played. They created a little drama together. And what I said in the book was that I found this very enchanting, because if you remember the stories of Hans Christian Andersen. Hans Christian Andersen, one of the greatest writers for children who probably ever lived, used to do that. I mean, he used to take little, you know, objects. There's a story called The Fir Tree, and he would take objects, you know, both, you know, and create and have them speak and anthropomorphize them and have them be characters. When I was teaching at Stanford University before I came to Maryland, I always teach a course called The Cultures of Childhood, sort of wherever I go. And I had this one student who remembered, and they often give presentations to each other, and I had this wonderful student who remembered that when she was a little girl, she and her daddy made up their stories about wonderful stories that went on and on and on, about, in which the characters were geometric shapes. So there was a triangle and a square and a circle. And she called her father, who was 3,000 miles away, to ask him if he remembered these stories. And they had a marvelous time, and she presented that to our class. So here you have this little girl who is talking to this mayonnaise jar. The mother gets into the act, and they create the play. And then at a certain point, the mother, who's very much in this role now, describes how the mayonnaise jar is eventually going to be, the little girl says, you're getting empty, mayonnaise jar, you're getting empty, what will happen to you? And the mayonnaise jar says that when she's empty, she will be taken to the recycling, and she'll be thrown in and be crashed into a million pieces, and that's going to be the end of her. When that happens, suddenly the little girl can't eat her lunch anymore, and she starts to cry. And at that moment, the mayonnaise jar stops being a mayonnaise jar and resumes being a mommy and takes the little girl in her lap and hugs her and kisses her and they laugh and it's over. But the moment when the little girl was so wrapped up in it that she actually became upset was a testament to what can happen when adults become very, very involved in the play of children. It can be scary because then the boundaries aren't there anymore, and the parent is the one who is the boundary setter, the boundary keeper, the holding, as Winnicott would call it. We mentioned him earlier. Donald Winnicott called it, he called it a holding environment. There is you create as an adult a holding, a stable environment for the child, so that the child feels held, emotionally held. And when the mother enters in to the play that way, there's no holding environment anymore. At the same time, it's wonderful and exciting, and all kinds of great things can happen. So it's very delicate. And I think it so much depends on individual factors, Celeste. I think it depends on the personality of the parents and the child. And I want to say one other thing about your great aunt and you, and going back to that, which is that I think that if you're not a parent or if you're not a particular child's parent, I think that that person, that adult, often is a little freer sometimes to be imaginative. Mm-hmm. You don't, because the agenda of a parent is so much to be protective. The responsibility, the weight of responsibility is so heavy on the parent to protect the child, to nurture the child, to worry about the child, to be, you know, conscientious about the child, that to free yourself up, to just play and just enjoy the child is much harder for that parent's child. And I wrote the book not really to give any rules or any even very many concrete suggestions, but really more as an inspiration, because I think that childhood is such a short, such a brief time of our lives, and to oppress it with too many rules and too many responses, well, all that will come later, but we need just to open the space, the breathing space, sort of the meadows of childhood need to be rediscovered.
Mm. You're talking here about internal spaces, and before we run out of time, I'd like you to talk about physical spaces, the physical geography of childhood, trees and tents and bedrooms and classrooms. And you have a chapter in the book, Children's Rooms, Sites of Refuge and Being Lost. And you say, spaces, as we like to think, can be inner or outer, but for children, the gates swing back and forth. So I guess really we are talking about internal and physical, both at the same time here. Would you tell us the story of how it was that your interest in childhood living in play spaces was sparked?
Well, yes. It's weird. I mean, I was involved, I was asked by one of the a curator was bringing over from London an exhibition which traveled around the United States for 2.5 years of the art collection of Sigmund Freud, who had a very, very extensive art collection of antiquities. Most of these were very small objects, small pieces, little figurines, and they came from ancient Egypt and Greece and Rome and China, Etruscan objects. And we gathered several hundred of them and made an exhibition and brought it to the United States. And they were traveled to many, many museums all over the country. I think definitely came to Illinois. While I was working on that, I learned a great deal about this this thinker's relationship to his objects. What he did was he collected these objects and he had them in his consulting room where he saw his patients. And these little objects were arrayed on his desk, and they were sort of sitting there as he thought about his patients' words that they were, the stories that they were telling him, and as he was writing his theoretical works, all these little objects were there. And when he would get a new one, he was advised by curators at the Vienna Kunsthistorisches Museum, and they would find objects for him, and he would get one. He would sometimes bring it to the dining room table and put it on the table as he ate, but it always ended up in his consulting room. And I thought about that, and I thought about how important it is, how important the objects are with which we surround ourselves. What kinds of objects do we surround ourselves with? The pictures on our walls, the colors that we choose for our homes. These surroundings do have an impact on us. It's very subtle. We don't really think about it except probably at the very beginning when we choose it. But then there they are. And when we're near them, we feel at home. We feel comfortable. And we always love coming back to the spaces where they are. And this made me think about, well, if this is so important for an adult like Sigmund Freud, how much more important it must be for small children whose psyches are being formed, who are learning what it is to be in the world, what importance it must be, the importance of what we surround them with in their spaces. And I began to think about the space that a child inhabits, mm-hmm. as sort of analogous to an artist's studio, because in a child's bedroom, the child thinks, the child is dreaming, the child is growing, or a scientist's laboratory, or I thought of Virginia Woolf, you know. I thought of how important these spaces are. And then I began to realize that grown-ups remember their childhood rooms, and I began to sort of do a little research, and I found that everybody, lots and lots of people, can remember all sorts of things about, you know, the way the sheets, you know, were very starched, or what you could see out of your window, or a special teddy bear that you had, and that's kind of how I got especially interested in it.
Very interesting. And you said something, what we surround them with. Would you talk about how we make those choices for our children?
Well, I think it's very very subtle. I think parents' aesthetic choices often entail covert expectations for their children, so that if it's a girl, you sort of try to sort of surround her with whatever, if you're so inclined, you know, sort of things that seem feminine to you, or if it's a boy, you do something different. We surround children with what we, that our own hopes for them somehow in very subtle ways get translated into what we provide mm-hmm. for them. And I also think that many parents today, and always, this is not just today, but are very influenced by, you know, by what other people do and by the culture at large, but sometimes for the worse. I mean, in the chapter on treasures, which is about objects that children hold on to and love and cherish, I sort of said there that I think that I think it's important for children to know that an object can be cherished without necessarily being owned, and that an object can be cherished which is not a replica of lots of other objects, and that an object gains importance sometimes because of the person who gave it to you, or an object gains importance because you've played with it, or because it was an object that belonged once upon a time to somebody else, and now it belongs to you. But it's redolent of its previous owners, somebody that you love that maybe isn't around anymore. So that objects don't just become important because they, I don't know, cost a certain amount of money, or because they're advertised, or because they're, you know, but they have other kinds of significance. I think that's very important for children to understand. And I think it carries over. Maybe this is going to sound too mystical, but I think that carries over into our human relationships. People are important, supremely important, and when you can value objects in a deeper way, there's a hope that one can also value human beings as well.
There we have to leave it. Professor Spitz, thank you very much for joining me this afternoon.
Oh, you're very welcome.